My name is Andrew Loney. I've worked as a literary agent for the last 40 years, but I'm also a writer and biographer, originally of literary biography and intelligence books, and more recently, royal biography. And it was the first of my royal biographies, a book called The Mountbattens, Their Lives and Loves, which led me to Southampton and the collection of the personal diaries and letters of Dickie and Edwina Mountbatten, which was
Yeah,
to
well,
form the
lovely.
backbone to this case.
Yeah, he's a fascinating guy, Mountie, as many people refer to him as. But can you just tell us, before we get into that, a little bit about the publishing world? Because certainly friends of mine say, well, it seems to have gone downhill, sort of since the 19, maybe 1970s till today. A lot of the stuff, they pick it up in a bookshop and they think, well, it doesn't look like much to read in this, nothing very exciting and not particularly good. So what's your thoughts on all that?
Well, I mean, my own feeling is I don't think the publishing has gone downhill. I think there are many more books published now. There are a wider range of voices coming out, many more publishers. The entry level to get into publishing, I mean, as a publisher, is much easier. I mean, you can now just, and indeed, people are publishing their own books. You can upload them onto Amazon's Kindle Direct program and sell them through Amazon. So I think the two things which were the game changers was Amazon, which basically allowed books to be sold all around the world, and particularly e-books to be sold very easily, and the end of the net book agreement. And this was basically a guaranteed price for books, which kept the price of books high, which protected authors and publishers, but of course wasn't so good for consumers. And I think, though the margins have been cut in publishing for everyone, I think we now have, much cheaper books, and the books that we have reflect the society we live in much more.
We're really here to talk about the Mountbatten Diaries. Can you just give us an idea of who he was?
Well, Dickie Mountbatten was a sort of Zelig-like figure who sort of embraced the whole of the 20th century. Born in 1900, he was assassinated by the IRA in 1979, but he managed to put sort of three lives into one. He was the head of combined operations during the war. He was the inspiration for the film In Which We Serve, made by his great friend Noel Coward. He was the Supreme Allied Commander in Southeast Asia. He was the youngest Vice Admiral since Nelson. Eventually, he was the last Viceroy of India and moved on to become Chief of the Defence Staff. So it's a pretty incredible career, and he's supported in all this by his wife, Edwina, who was, when he married her in 1922, the richest heiress in the world. And he was a mentor to four generations of the royal family, beginning with Edward VIII, to whom he was best man, George VI, with whom he was very close and indeed plotted the marriage of Philip and Elizabeth to the Queen when she first came to the throne in 1952, and more latterly to the present king, who called him his honorary grandfather.
Now, this was an interesting period, wasn't it? Really, he sort of presided over the decline and fall of the British Empire.
Yes, I think what's so interesting about Mountbatten is he encompasses, say, the whole of the 20th century. I mean, his cousins were members of the Russian royal family. He had a rather sort of adolescent crush on one of the Tsar's daughters. And he was the last godchild of Queen Victoria and her great grandson. So he stretches really from the 19th century through to almost the end of the 20th century. Clearly, I mean, one of his daughters is still alive. He was one of those figures who just managed to get everywhere and to get involved with so many different areas of public life.
Now, you mentioned he's a Zelig-like figure. Who is Zelig? Who was Zelig?
Well, Zelig is this figure who just basically pops up, I think, in a Woody Allen film at all the great moments in history. And Mountbatten was a bit the same. He knew everyone, and I think this is what made him such an attractive sort of mentor to people like King Charles.
So when did you first get interested in some of his memoirs? These are letters, I believe. What were they, and how did you get involved?
Well, when I began to research the Mountbatten book in 2015, I decided to move from my previous subject, which was a book about the spy Guy Burgess, to Mountbatten. Burgess and Mountbatten had been at the same prep school. They were at Dartmouth, I'd read the Philip Ziegler's book on Mountbatten, which was an official life written 40 years before, and I realized that there was a lot more that could be said about Mountbatten, and particularly through the prism of looking at him through his marriage, which was a slightly unusual marriage in that it was an open marriage. The two of them had numerous affairs with members of both sex and various colors. So it was very interesting to look at it that way and to look at the private and public partnership. Now, when I began the research, I knew that previous biographers had used the personal diaries and letters of Edwina and Dickie, which had been kept at their country home, Broadlands, but had then been bought under a big public campaign by the University of Southampton to be open to all, bought, I have to say, with public monies. And so I approached the University of Southampton saying, could I look at these personal diaries and letters? They're very useful for a biographer. They give us dates and events and clearly the intimacy of a marriage, people talking very openly to each other. And they claim to know nothing about these diaries or letters or to have any contact details for anyone who might know anything about them.
What? Mean, they must have been aware that they'd paid good money for these letters.
Well, I'm afraid this was the first of many lies that I and others have been told by the University of Southampton and others on this issue. But of course they knew, we know now from the correspondence that there was stuff going on behind the scenes with relation to these diaries and letters. But what seems to have happened is that when they were bought in 2011, and they were bought under the acceptance and loose scheme, which is a tax avoidance scheme, basically to avoid paying tax, and on the basis that this material is always open to the public, it was bought for close to £3 million. And they then closed it. And it was closed on the say-so of one particular archivist, the man actually who had orchestrated this public funding of the collection, on the grounds that there was sensitive raw material in it. And instead of going through it and seeing what might be sensitive, they basically closed the whole lot. And that was the line that they held with researchers until I came along in 2015. And I didn't believe them. Eventually I took the matter to the Information Commissioner, who's the regulator for information policy or freedom of information. He agreed with me that this material should be open, and issued a decision notice that they should open it. I should say that this had taken several years. It had actually had the unprecedented occurrence of the Information Commissioner beginning contempt proceedings in the High Court against Southampton for failing to respond to their information notices. But eventually, this decision notice was brought out. Southampton appealed it. They were joined in this by the Cabinet Office. The Cabinet Office claimed to have an involvement because there was a ministerial direction, they claimed, that required all this material to be closed, that Mountbatten had agreed that this material should be vetted. And so I found myself being dragged into this appeal, which was against the Information Commissioner, but where the Information Commissioner frankly wasn't doing anything. And so I had to bring in lawyers myself at huge cost to respond to this. The Southampton Cabinet Office managed to kick this down the road for a couple of years, claiming that they would, it was just during COVID that they had all sorts of problems educating children at home and things. But eventually, in the end of 2021, the hearing was set. Now, in case management instructions by the judge in the spring of that year, he decreed that Southampton should make this material available to him for him to decide if it should be closed. And we're talking here about 30, over 33,000 pages of documentation. So it's a large amount of material to be just totally closed on the grounds that it may be sensitive. And remember, these are personal diaries, the sort of thing that you might keep to make notes about who you were seeing next week. And these letters are between a married couple. They're hardly likely to be talking about particularly sensitive material connected with the royals. And
Now, just
so
a
this.
second, sorry, because something that occurs to me is obviously this Mountbatten was very close to, as he was at the time, Prince Charles. Is it likely that this is something where Charles is saying, well, I'd actually rather like to protect my mentor's private information. I don't want it being made public.
Well, the material that was closed stretched from 1922 to 1979. So a lot of it was about people who were long dead. And we know from the published diaries of Mountbatten, because in fact, what Siegler had done in the 1980s is publish some of the material that was now closed, that the material was completely innocuous. It's Lilibet has come across for tea, Prince Philip has come for riding. That was the sort of stuff that was in the diaries. So it was ridiculous to say that this stuff should be closed. There was no obligation on Southampton University to, in fact, imply any of the FOI exemptions unless they were very critical ones, such as national security. But that really didn't come into this collection. And of course, this is an academic institution which should be in favour of knowledge and knowledge being spread, rather than suppressing it. So it was an extraordinary decision by a university, publicly funded, to close material bought with public funds.
Now, when you came to appeal, you must have been wondering, well, how much is this going to cost me?
Yes, I mean, I really spent a little bit on lawyers because we'd had a long fight to challenge the ministerial direction. The ministerial direction, which was the center point of their case, was actually dropped before the hearings. So that was money that was wasted. We had throughout the discussions, my lawyers had made plain that we would be seeking costs because of their unreasonable behavior, and also because in effect I'd succeeded. I'd had got 99% of the material released before the hearing. What they actually did was rather than supply it to the judge, they just dumped it on the internet before the hearing. So I thought that I would get my costs, and therefore I kept going. But in the end, the judge, for whatever reason, and the judge, I should say, was dropped. The good judge, shall we say, the good judge who was supportive was dropped, and a new judge was brought in who was
Oh.
less sympathetic. I was not awarded my costs, and I was left with a bill of just under £500,000, £78,000 of which I got from some crowdfunding, but the rest I pretty much had to spend, I had to pay for myself, which required me basically drawing on all my savings. I'm a man in my 60s, so this was money for my retirement. So ISAs, remortgaging houses, all that had to take place, a legacy from my mother. So it was a huge financial burden, which was ridiculous that a member of the public should have to go through these costs to secure material that was bought for the public with public monies.
Well, isn't that fascinating that they've swapped the judge around as well? What was the excuse the judge used to impose costs on you, even though you'd won?
Well, it was a slightly complicated case in which there were various counter appeals. And I think the feeling was that when it came to the case, there was still 100 redactions that the Southampton had insisted should be kept in the material. Very difficult to challenge those redactions because all you get is a blacked out bit of paper with a date. We were able to show that some of the stuff that they were trying to withhold was already in published diaries, so that was a ridiculous thing. But they, and there were other things. So, for example, there was a quote or a line from Edwina saying that Jinnah, who was the Muslim leader, was a psychopath, and they felt that this would upset the Pakistan government, even though it's well known that Edwina had a pretty critical view of Jinnah. They were trying to suppress a reference to a Second World War intelligence organization, even though there have been books written about this organization, and there are numerous papers relating to it in the archives at Southampton. So there were a
Well, no,
lot
well,
of
hang on, hang on. What organization is that? That sounds fascinating.
well, it was just a sort of just another sort of special operations executive, so nothing very special. But they had a whole series of objections, for example, to the naming of bodyguards, even though you can read books now by current members of the royals that will name their bodyguards. I mean, I'm doing a book at the moment on the Duke and Duchess of York, and I've got about 30 names of bodyguards, which I've just collected from newspaper cuttings and from previous books on them. So these things are not a secret, but Southampton felt that they were. Going right back to, as I say, almost 100 years ago.
Okay, so once the they have been revealed, obviously you're talking about them being published online as well. What it, revelations are in there? We obviously we don't know what's under the redacted, and that may be the most interesting material. But what have you discovered from them?
Well, from the 33,000 pages that were released, there was nothing. It was all innocuous. It was like two bald men fighting over a comb. And we know also from the stuff that they attempted to redact that we could identify from published diaries that that also was innocent. So I think that everything was innocent, and this was just a power game. And they had to save face by having something kept back. Otherwise, it would have been pretty embarrassing.
Okay, so what about what does this tell us about the role of the royals? I think there was quite a battle with Charles when he was Prince Charles for him to make sure that he wasn't subject to any of these freedom of information requests. So, in order to be a bit aloof, really, from the legal system, I mean, he doesn't consider himself to be part of the government. He's just above all that, really. And so what does
Well,
what you, the battle that you've had tell us about the way the royals see themselves?
I mean, one of the exemptions in the Freedom of Information Act is Section 37, which is communications with basically the royal family. So anything relating to the royal family can be taken out of records and even personal records like this. And it's one of the things that FOI campaigners have been long saying that this is ridiculous. There should be a public interest test, and they shouldn't be basically given a get out of jail free card. I think what we also saw here was that Southampton had invited members of the royal household to come and vet this collection. This collection, which was in effect owned by Southampton, had been freely sold by the family. If it had been sold to an American institution, for example, the whole lot would have been released a decade before. So there were no grounds really to let someone else come and poke around. So there's a lot of deference there to the royal family from this academic institution, which should be in favor of academic scholarship. But I think it just says quite a lot too about how and it's in the news at the moment, this trust relationship that one has to have with the royal family and how they curate the record. We do not get the full story because records are held back. I'm trying to write a book on Prince Andrew at the moment, on his position as a trade envoy. And this was a public position paid for by the taxpayer, quite separate from his position in the royal family. And yet all the records are closed, when they should by law be in the National Archives. And I've discovered that any records relating to Prince Andrew will not be opened until 2065, which 105 years after his death. So, well, there's really no opportunity to have any scrutiny of what these people are up to. I've just written a book called Traitor King about Edward VIII, and what I managed to discover there was that the former King of England was a traitor to this country and could well have been executed if they decided to take action against him because of his treacherous activities. With Mountbatten, one of the disclosures was that he had abused two teenage boys. A third one has now come forward. A boy of 12 has come forward, has got a case in the courts in Ireland. And this was all covered up. My own feeling as a monarchist is that the bad apples spoil it for everyone else. It destroys trust in the institution. And of course, it opens up, if you don't communicate properly, it opens up a vacuum for speculation, which is what we've seen with the photo and the reluctance to say what has happened to the Princess of Wales.
It's worth noting, isn't it, that there was a revelation that actually the press policy for the royals had been written by Jimmy Savile, of all people. But look, don't you think there's a danger that this is all kind of backfiring? This, as you described it, this kind of get out of jail free card.
Yes, I think people are getting wise. I mean, I've been long campaigning for more transparency about all records. I mean, a lot of records, but 95% of even government records are destroyed, and we don't even know what they were. But I think the royals, if they're going to command respect and trust, they have to be slightly more open about their activities. And if there are some bad apples there, they need to fess up to that, not cover it up. So it is a growing problem, I think. We're seeing a rise in republicanism because we feel, we're not being told, for example, how much the royal family cost, the cost of protection. Are they good value for money? If they are paid for by the taxpayer, I think they have a certain obligation to justify their existence. And I say that as a monarchist, but it's a wider problem about our history being curated by rich and powerful people to protect their own interests.
Well, a lot of
And we do
people have
not.
pointed out that when the Queen died, there was no inheritance tax whatsoever on their. I mean, obviously, they would have been subject to masses and masses of inheritance tax if they were ordinary citizens, but it's almost like not a word is said. But anyway, look, just as a final question, you talked about Edward VIII. He was probably somebody that many people, certainly of older generations, would see as Britain's dodgiest king ever. Can you tell us why you decided to write about him and any of the maybe some of the things you found out about Edward VIII? He was known, wasn't he, to have had Nazi sympathies.
Well, that's why I call the book Traitor King. It's a joint portrait of him and Wallace. That's never been done before. It's the second of these royal marriages books. The third is the Andrew and Fergie one. It begins where all the other books on Edward tend to end, which is the abdication. We forget that he lived for another 50 years after that, or his wife did. And there's a whole story about what happened to him in exile in France and America. But it's very clear that even before he became king, he was very close to the Nazis. One of the reasons that, in some ways, the government was keen to get rid of him, and they'd rather use Wallace as an excuse to get rid of him, was because of these Nazi sympathies. He continued to consort with them even after the war began. There's a famous moment in the summer of 1940 where the Germans approach him to come back as a puppet king should they invade Britain. He tries to keep America out of the war. When he's in the Bahamas as governor, it's a subject of a documentary on Channel 5, which is being shown shortly. Also, their relationship was not the great love affair that everyone imagines. She felt trapped. He had basically played an emotional blackmail on her and said he would commit suicide if she didn't marry him. She found him boring. He was like a sort of. It was sort of puppy love. He was obsessed with her. A lot of parallels actually between Harry and Meghan now. They were basically kept out of Britain. They didn't really have any proper jobs. They took advantage of the position to make money by endorsing products. There was the same problem as with Harry and Meghan to try and again curate the narrative by suing members of the press or bringing in tame biographers. And there was the same fallout within the family of not getting on, disputes over money and security, all the sort of things that we're seeing now happened with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor 50 years ago. So
Amazing.
it is a
Just
pretty
one little
unedifying
thing
spectacle.
about this, and maybe you can corroborate it or not, is I think it was Karina Orbach in Germany who published some amazing allegations from the German archives, saying that Edward had been over in Lisbon after the beginning of the war. Just I think it was during the Phoney War, just before the hostilities really broke out, actually encouraging the Germans to start bombing London, saying, "Well, look, if you start bombing London, that then the British may well come straight away and sue for peace." And so that sounds incredible to have a king of Britain actually encouraging the Nazis to start the Blitz.
Yes, exactly. No, she's done good work, really, also in the Russian and Spanish archives. But this is the moment in July 1940 when he's consorting with the Germans. I found Portuguese Secret Service files showing how he was in and out of the German embassy discussing this. He tried to delay his return to Britain while these negotiations were going on. And this extortion to bomb Britain also appears, for example, in some of the diaries of people who were moving in those circles, and is the was discussed in a documentary I made with the title Traitor King for Channel 4. So, I mean, these allegations are well known, well substantiated by serious historians, and yet people refuse. Some historians, well, some writers refuse to believe them when the evidence is there and has been ignored. for 50 years. The Churchill threatening to court-martial the Duke in July 1940 has been in Churchill's papers for many years, and no one until really me has actually used that material, and one has to ask why.
Well, I suppose it's the still the deference, maybe. Anyway, I mean, I'm almost hesitant to ask you to tell us about, your publications about Mountbatten, because you've said yourself there's nothing really entertaining, or there's nothing really controversial in there.
Well, there's a lot of that's very controversial and entertaining in the book I
Ah,
wrote,
is there? Right, okay.
and it was a Sunday Times top 10 bestseller. I mean, some of the disclosures made the front page of the Sunday Times. It was serialized by the Times. So there's a lot in that book, which basically turns Philip Ziegler's previous book on its head. But I think the point is that this fight over this 33,000 pages, which I'd hoped would have some disclosures, really had nothing. It was a fight over nothing. And it was a
Gosh.
fight, basically. And that's what makes it such a waste of time and money. Because if I spent £500,000, what did the government and Southampton pay when I had a junior barrister and they had top QCs?
Yeah, they probably spent a lot more than you did. What's the title?
The title of the Mountbatten's book is The Mountbattens, Their Lives and Loves.
Okay, Andrew Lowney, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.